Fiona Reed, one of your shows has opened and you're rehearsing for another show. How complicated is that for a performer?
Not very. You create two different houses in your brain. And it's just the sheer, I think it's just the sheer physical demands of working a lot on two plays. One, you're performing, and because I'm on stage pretty well all the time in charity, it takes up a lot of my energy. I have to get a quick nap before I do a sort of a four-hour rehearsal in the evening for the other play, for The Sea. So they're both very demanding roles in different ways, and I just have to be on my toes, watch what I eat, and be careful that I try and get at least 5 or 6 hours sleep. I can't really get more than that, I find. But
St. John Hankin is always talked about as kind of a successor to Oscar Wilde, and I gather Edward Bond is different.
Yes, they're both very funny, though. They're both sort of tragically funny, and I think sometimes people confuse the idea of a comedy as being light or superficial, but what I always like to say to people is that comedy and, well, the serious issues and laughter and tears reside in the same part of our brain. And sometimes if you're not going to, you think, well, I'm either going to laugh or I'm going to cry. You know, you may as well laugh because you could cry, but you're going to laugh instead. And I do believe that real comedy resides in that place. And so there's nothing light, really, about either play, but I would say both have hilarity in them, in that life is hilarious, I think. You have to laugh.
So this is why The Cherry Orchard is a comedy.
That's right. Yes, you're very wise to point to Chekhov, because both these plays, the charity that began at home by St. John Hankins and The Sea by Edward Bond, are comedies in as much as Chekhov is funny. There are farcical elements in as much as people can be ridiculous. You know, I'm trying to get my maid to stop crying, and I say things that possibly sound mean if taken in isolation, but her crying is in driving me nuts. So it's indeed what I have to say at that moment. And just in charity, these are people who are really trying to do good. They are trying to be philanthropic to people, and it ends up being way more confusing than they'd ever envisaged, and quite complicated. And it just shows how good intentions can go awry.
Lady Denison in Charity, who's kind of the person about whom the whole plot seems to spin, comes across to me as pretty ditzy and a little out of touch.
Yes, I don't see her that way. I mean, I know that I'm crocheting, and I tend to drop my wool every time I stand up. But when Chris mentioned that early on in rehearsals, I was not resistant to it, but I wanted to find how I would incorporate that. And so I didn't initially think about it at all. And I think it's just how she appears, because the things she's focused on are perhaps not the most practical things at any given moment, but she is trying to please everybody. And I think it's a wonderful examination of the hostess with the mostest. But, you know, suddenly when somebody asks if they can write letters in her study, it just is like, well, yes, I wanted you in my home, and I wanted you to have a lovely time on the terrace. But now you're asking me if you can write letters in my study. And it just all gets a little close to home. And I won't say way more happens than that. That's just a tiny example. But one thing compounds on another.
This is written about a very, very different time than today. Mm. At the same time, the issues and the unfrocked minister who's at the center of this thing, Hilton, sounds an awful lot like standard liberal cocktail party stuff.
Yes, it's true. I mean, there are the notions of class. There are certain things that certain formalities that are observed between the upper classes and the lower classes. And I think it's there's a wonderful laughter at the beginning when I say, oh, how troublesome servants are, because people must be thinking, yeah, as if, lady, you know, you've got someone to make your bed in the morning. But I'm as concerned about the hired help's lives and how they're getting on as I am about the relationships in my own direct family. I think that a lot of it is fascinating in the way that we are fascinated with the relationships in Downton Abbey, that Yes, there are certain strictures about how people behave with one another, and certainly when it comes to my daughter getting married, parental her responsibilities to her parents or to her mother in this case are probably more clearly drawn than they are today. But it the play is so wonderfully truthful. There are many shades of gray and many complications, and I think it must ring true or people wouldn't laugh to the degree that they do. And I think the elements that are slightly arcane are, I'm sure, wonderful to look on, because they're, it's not so long ago, and people were still people even though they had those the strictures of class. And in some ways you think, oh gosh, thank goodness we're free of that. And yet we're not, in a way. I mean, the rich certainly behave with a sense of entitlement. It may be a surprise to people that people with this amount of income would care so much about being philanthropic. It's interesting. We could all talk about class for days and how class permeates North American society in a different way than in British society, but it still does.
There's quite an age spread among the cast and the characters they're playing. But is it sometimes hard with younger performers who may have less experience with life or on the stage than you've had to understand some of this stuff?
Well, this is where Christopher Newton was so extraordinary, because he doesn't treat anybody any differently. And so he'll let things go for about 2 weeks, and then he'll say, you can't have your hands in your pockets, you know, when you're talking to her. And certain things like that, that you just, that's not how you, you know, as a footman, that is not how you would have. Sherry Flett is in charge. She's in our company, and she's just extraordinary. She's in our cast, and she deals with what's called manners and the mandate. And so she will say to someone playing a footman, well, this is how you would hand the teacup and saucer to Lady Denison, and this is how you would serve the grapes, and things like that. She's marvelously knowledgeable. One does forget, and it's really important to be reminded and to do things just properly.
Now, Christopher is only here part-time, but he's a big supporter of St. John Hankin, who is not a well-known performer, and I did some research on it the other day. For about 75 years, nobody did anything of his.
No.
And Hankin started to come back, and he's been done here before. Does it leave performers a little confused, because they know nothing about the guy? They haven't done any of his plays in grad school, sort of thing, and suddenly Jackie Maxwell, the artistic director, says, you will be so-and-so in such-and-such, and you say,
yeah.
Who and what?
Exactly. I think probably we all did. Even I did, too, and I read the play, and I thought, are people going to get this? This is, you know, people talk in such long sentences and paragraphs. But Christopher brought it to life so much. This play completely took him over. He loved it, and he was determined to show that people were no different in 1907 than they are today, whether they be, you know, the Lord of the Manor or down the servants' stairs, you know, down in the servants' quarters. And I think that's the miracle of it, really. And the eccentricities of people, and how, you know, a boring person then is the same as a boring person now, and a boorish person then is, you know, we recognize all those things. So I think for all of us, it felt a little bit unattainable. And then Chris, he was just fantastic. I can't go on enough about him. Right away he said, on about day two, he said to Julie and me, you're both being far too nice. Just stop it, you know, because I think we were playing generously hearted people, so we were putting on our nice shoes, and he just thought, no, I want to see real people that I would relate to doing these things, as opposed to people that, oh, they're just too nice to be believable. His instincts were marvelous on this.
He's a Brit originally. He grew up over there, went to school over there before he came to the U.S. for graduate school. Does he bring a different understanding of the social currents?
Sure, he does. Also, he's extraordinarily well-read, and musically, his musical knowledge is quite, well, very impressive. I don't want to speak for Christopher, but I think he feels so strongly Canadian. He first went to university, I think, in the United States, in the Midwest, in Nebraska, I can't remember. Anyway, somewhere in the Midwest. Maybe that isn't the Midwest. I wasn't paying attention. I went to school in suburban D.C., and I don't think I was paying attention for sure. I know there are 52, maybe 53 states. Anyway, that's the end of it. Chris really, I think, identifies with Canada as a Canadian. I don't think he'd be comfortable living in Britain, but he certainly, that was his heritage, and he is so well-read that he knows everything about history and this mandate, and is fascinated by it, I think.
You've worked at the two principal theater companies here in Niagara-on-the-Lake and in the other place. Does it help if you do plays of certain periods year after year? Do you get a better idea of the body language and the costumes you'll wear and the time?
Sure. I'm very comfortable in this period. There are a few of us in the company who actually love to be corseted, actually love to be constrained, because we actually find freedom in that, and our rib cages are used to it. I just adore this period and feel really comfortable, and I know not to fight when the extraordinary designer Bill Schmuck wants to give me a bustle, because I already think my rear end's big enough, and I know not to argue because he's looking for a certain line in the costume. Yes, I really, really appreciate this period in particular, I have to say, and I look fondly back at the other heroines I've played, Jane in Cavalcade and Private Lives, and it sort of runs the gamut from 1900 onwards, and I'm very, very comfortable and it does help to have done it before and to have some sense of how one moves and speaks and sits, and certain things are just automatic. I mean, in some people that aren't used to it, you can feel it's a modern person in the costume, and the costume's wearing them almost. And if not, it, the way it should be is you inhabit it, and you live and breathe and feel comfortable in it.
There's a reference in the program to Hankin being kind of a transition figure between Oscar Wilde and Noel Coward.
That's really interesting. Oscar Wilde, I would have to say, is my very, very favorite playwright. Again, he gets misunderstood as being sort of only witty and epigrammatic, but he's far more than that. He's all about love and frustrated love and the hypocrisy of society. But yes, I think Hankin has a bit of Wilde in him. He's got a bit of Chekhov in him, and possibly even a bit of Coward. It's all about the spoken word and the cadence of the thought, and there's a great deal of irony in I would say amongst all those playwrights, that they all use irony to great purpose.
Shaw Festival pushes student theater in the spring. Kids are up here and they see shows. Do they show that they're absolutely clueless about the kind of period you're talking about here with the Hankin play, Charity?
We haven't had students yet, and we're going to have to help them, I would think. But I bet you know, students, kids especially, always surprise me. I think, oh, this won't be accessible for them. And they completely get it. So hopefully it inspires debate and maybe curiosity about the period for them. But I look forward to being surprised by their reactions.
Now you're doing another play, and you're in rehearsals right now. Tell me about Sea.
Oh, The Sea is extraordinary. Again, it takes place in the same year, 1907, and there's a man is drowned at sea, a young man, and the survivor is a man from away, and he comes in to the community, and it's really about the suspicions of the community about this man as an outsider. And there is a man with a drapery shop who has very bizarre notions about outsiders and foreigners and people from away. And he's got a plot in his head about visitors from outer space, alien, space aliens. This is in 1907. And my character is the matriarch of the town, and she's a real indomitable Iron Lady. She is Margaret Thatcher times 100. And she rules this community with an iron fist. And she crosses heads with the Draper. And it's about what happens in this town dealing with this tragedy between the Draper and Mrs. Raffy. Now, you know when you explain the play, you always make it about your character. I'm sure if you spoke to anybody else, they would say it was about their character. But Mrs. Raffy is a fascinating woman. And this is a play that is part farce, part tragedy, but it really is about the human spirit and about the human ability to survive, to suffer and to survive. And there's some beautiful, beautiful poetry in this play. It's starkly beautiful, and it always has the sea metaphor there all the time, which is being beautifully done by Camilla Koo, our designer, you know, that courthouse space, to transform that into the sea, that's a huge feat of design brilliance, and Camilla is just the person to do it.
How hard is it to run the lines in a rehearsal when you're fairly new in the other show you're doing? Do you ever pick up the wrong cue?
No, it's funny. You know, you put yourself in those circumstances and you're in that world and there's no problem. But right now I'm just on the cusp of being sure of my lines in the sea. And I still, because the vernacular is quite complicated, and I like to be word perfect in Charity, I do sort of go to the theater earlier and just go over certain passages just to be sure. I never like to feel cocky or confident.
I've had performers at Stratford tell me, as they've worked their way up from being spear carriers to lead roles in plays, that they sometimes react to the cue from the last time they did this show.
Oh, how fascinating. Well, if you do the same play, and I suppose with Shakespeare's that can happen, that you... No, I tend to really put them safely to bed. And I, especially if someone else were playing a part that I had played some years ago, I would really make sure I put that to bed because I think it would be roundly confusing. And I wouldn't want to be seeing myself in that part. I only want to see that person in that part.
Now, this is the time of year when Jackie, for her final season, is putting together the schedule for next year. Mm. Have you told her you'd like to do this or that?
Well, I don't do that because I don't really have the imagination to be thinking of projects, and I think that really is her purview. And so I would really wait for her to make the move. But, you know, there are a couple of workshops going on here, and maybe those plays might have future lives. But I leave that to her.
In the years that Jackie's been here, in the years that Christopher was here, they've broadened the mandate of the festival considerably and brought in a lot of new writers. I mean, when Christopher first brought St. John Hankin here, people, including me, said, who?
Yeah.
But Bond for the Sea. Yeah. Is this good for an actor?
Oh, yes. I mean, what it is now, what the door that they opened up was to say that if you are a more modern writer who lived after Shaw's death, who has written about the period of Shaw's lifetime, then you are admissible as a playwright. That's part of our mandate. And I think it's only been wonderful because it just sheds different eyes on the period. And Edward Bond is reflecting as a brilliant playwright in the early 70s on a time, 60 years previous. And it's marvelous because he's dealing with nuclear proliferation and looking back to a time when they were looking at the conditions for the First World War. They were dealing with pre-First World War conditions. And then you get the mirror of, oh my gosh, the issues that he's dealing with and grappling with in the 70s and that they were dealing with pre-First World War. Indeed, we are now still dealing. You can now say we are looking back on issues that mirror our own time. So you get these refracted images of different times, and it allows you to take a larger arc of history when you're looking back and forward in terms of the themes of the play. I think it's marvelous.
Do you ever run across any anachronisms because between someone, say, like Hankin or Shaw from then and a writer writing today about the period?
All the time. all the time. I mean, we have one going on right now in charity in terms of there's a sexual encounter amongst the serving staff, amongst between a footman and a lady's maid, and putting the view, today's view on it, some people might look at it one way and other people might look at it another way. And you know what I say to people like that? I say, don't be revisionist. There are many shades of gray. And life and truth and art usually resides in the shades of gray. And I don't mean those shades of gray. I'm not talking that kind of thing, not that book. I'm talking about life and art.
Thank you, Fiona Reid.